From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Tanya Mosley. It's Here and Now. In a week when the U.S. surpassed 150,000 coronavirus deaths, health officials addressed the pandemic on Capitol Hill today, and Dr. Anthony Fauci expressed optimism about a vaccine.
There's never a guarantee that you're going to get a safe and effective vaccine. But from everything we've seen now in the animal data, as well as the early human data, we feel cautiously optimistic that we will have a vaccine by the end of this year and as we go into 2021.
Fauci is, of course, the director of the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases. He was joined by Dr. Robert Redfield, director of the CDC. NPR science correspondent Richard Harris joins us now. And Richard, let's start with what we learned about vaccines. Dr. Fauci was asked about safety, the timeline, who would get a vaccine. What did we learn?
Yeah, well, we heard Dr. Fauci once again expressing his cautious optimism, and he also said that although not everyone will be able to get the vaccine immediately, he was hopeful that basically it could actually we could actually know by the late fall or early winter whether, in fact, we have an effective vaccine. Take a while to gear it up. He said it might even take the entire year of 2021 to get vaccine to all Americans, because even if you know if it works, you've got the production issues, you've got to figure out how to distribute it, et cetera, et cetera. But what they're currently having a discussion about is trying to prioritize who will get it first. Of course, in similar circumstances, medical personnel and other first responders who are most likely to be exposed to a disease do get priority. But those discussions right now are just going on, so we'll have to see how it shakes out for coronavirus. A lot of other wrinkles there, too.
And what about schools? School reopenings also came up. Here's what Dr. Robert Redfield of the CDC had to say.
It's in the public health best interest of K through 12 students to get back in face-to-face learning. There's really very significant public health consequences of the school closure.
What was his reasoning there as to why it is in the public health best interest for schools to reopen?
Well, schools provide all sorts of care to children. For example, recognizing getting help for children who are abused. Also, he said more than 7 million children get mental health care through their schools. Other medical care also comes from school nurses and clinics. And of course, you know, school is important for both intellectual and social development, making a whole human being. So all that needs to be weighted against the risk to children, the risk to the teachers and the staff. And let's not forget the children's families. Kids right. are much less, themselves are much less likely to get seriously ill, but they can bring the disease home to vulnerable family members, and that can keep the pandemic spreading. So it's a complicated calculus there.
I want to ask you about some NPR reporting today about a controversial change this month in how the Trump administration is requiring hospitals to report data on coronavirus cases. Instead of reporting to the CDC, they must now report to the Department of Health and Human Services. The aim, the government says, is to speed up reporting. But your colleagues at NPR found delays and inaccuracies and the fact that the data won't be reported daily as first promised, but now only weekly. What more do we know about this?
Right. This is continued reporting from my colleagues Selena Simmons-Duffin and Ping Wong. And, you know, they are reporting on some of the problems that hospitals have had making this sudden move and really quite unexpected right in the middle of a pandemic. And one consequence of that is that data are not being released as rapidly as they used to be by the CDC, as you mentioned. It seems, in fact, that, you know, it can be a week between reports, and that's a problem for people who are trying to make use of this data rapidly, for example, to move supplies where they're needed.
The topic of this new system of reporting came up in today's hearing, right?
It did. And one thing we learned today in that hearing is that Dr. Redfield, the head of the CDC, admitted he wasn't involved in the decision to make the switch. And it appears he didn't even learn about it or much of anything about it in advance. So even so, he praised the system that was imposed upon him by his higher-ups and said that it needed to be to be in place to help the federal government distribute a drug that's in short supply called remdesivir, and that helps people with coronavirus who are seriously ill. Congresswoman Maxine Waters, a California Democrat, challenged him on that, saying that, you know, hospitals who have had trouble working with the new reporting system may actually have more trouble getting the drug. And Redfield said that they are working to avoid that.
Richard, there were repeated questions from Democrats today about why there have been so many more deaths in the U.S. than in European and Asian countries, and whether a poor federal response was to blame. Just briefly, how did Fauci answer that question?
Well, he explained, as he did before, that European countries were very effective at their initial round of shutting things down. It was something like a 95% successful rate of getting people to stay home. The contrast in the U.S. is it was only about 50% effective. And when officials decided to open up again, that meant there was a lot more virus circulating, so it really took off. So the message now is wear your mask, socially mm-hmm. distance, and so on, and try to crush the virus without actually having to resort to another lockdown.
NPR science correspondent Richard Harris. Richard, thank you.
Sure.
Much of the chaos in Portland, Oregon has died down. Officials there reporting that last night's protests were largely peaceful after federal officers agreed to pull back their presence in force. And the city of Oakland voted this week to block any federal officers from acting against protesters there after the president proposed to intervene in the city and other places, too, like New York City and Chicago. Joining us now is the mayor of Oakland, Libby Schaff. Thanks for being here.
Oh, thanks for having me, Tanya.
And Mayor, you've joined with other mayors who are strongly against this idea of federal officers coming into your city. Can you say more on why?
Well, we saw what a disaster it was in Portland. This president seems more intent on creating campaign ads that slander progressive, diverse cities like Oakland than actually restoring public safety. Now, let's be clear. I have no tolerance for vandalism, but I know my community far better than this president. And I know that sending unwanted troops with no coordination or supervision by local authorities is a recipe for disaster and more civil unrest. And it was encouraging that just as we were starting our press conference, the federal government agreed to withdraw troops from Portland. And we are very hopeful that he will not overstep and abuse his authority anymore.
You mentioned you have no tolerance for violence. We know that Oakland protests actually turned violent earlier this week. There was a setting of fire at a courthouse. They vandalized a police station, smashed windows, pointed lasers at officers. Also, I want to talk about, though, other crimes. Shootings are way up in Oakland compared to last year. Your own home has been vandalized. When it comes to violent crime, aside from the protests, places like Chicago, Baltimore, and New York have actually turned to Washington for help. Do you think local officials in Oakland could use any support from the federal government in the way of bringing down violent crime?
You know, Oakland has received national recognition for cutting gun violence in half through the ceasefire approach. And that includes a partnership with local federal law enforcement. That partnership has been in place for years, but it's under the direction of local government. We direct that partnership. What was different about what happened in Portland was federal troops being sent in against the will and over the protest of local government and with no coordination, no supervision by local officials. Partnerships are great when they are focused and led by the local knowledge. So that's what we've been proud to see in Oakland through our ceasefire initiative, which really treats gun violence as a public health problem, not as much as a crime problem. It involves a lot of non-law enforcement partners that really communicate to people and say, we want you to live and be free, and we are here to support you in those choices. But those who do get involved with gun violence, they will face prosecution. And there is a real focus on making sure that we address violent crime first in our community above all other types of crime.
I want to ask you about policing a little bit more. So you voted against more cuts to Oakland's police department recently. Now your city council has unanimously voted to form a task force that will look at how to cut the police department's budget in half over the next 2 years. Is that realistic, a 50% budget cut for the police department there in 2 years?
You know, I think Oakland is doing this right. We responded immediately to calls to defund police by making a more than $14 million cut to our police department's budget. But when some council members wanted to make additional cuts, we could see that that could not be done without eliminating a particular service or response capacity from our police department. And those council members were unwilling to identify which service or which impact this cut would result in. And so that's why this task force is the right way to do it. This task force does not have the power to actually cut 50% of the police department budget. What they do have is the responsibility to analyze the possibilities, to make sure that this process is transparent and community-led. And that work over the next 6 months will then inform my creation of the budget as well as the council's ultimate passage. It is so important that we don't just respond without any analysis or impact data, without any transparency or information for our public. We'll see if it results in a 50% cut, but at least we'll have the information and the recommendations from this committed group of residents.
That's Oakland Mayor Libby Schaaf. Thank you so much, Mayor.
Thank you. Have a good one.
The Emmy nominations came out this week, and one of the big winners was the Canadian comedy Schitt's Creek. That's S-C-H-I-T-T-S. It got 15 nominations, including for Outstanding Comedy Series, Outstanding Writing, and all four actors that play the Rose family were nominated. Eugene Levy and Catherine O'Hara for lead roles, and Dan Levy and Annie Murphy for supporting roles. The show is about a wealthy family that suddenly loses everything and moves into a dumpy motel in a small rural town called Schitt's Creek that they once bought as a joke. I spoke with the show's co-creators Eugene Levy and Dan Levy last year at the start of the fifth season and began by asking where the idea came from, because it's a very different show than anything I'd seen before.
Thank you very much.
In a great way. I mean, I've watched every episode of it so far.
I brought sort of the first germ of an idea to my dad very early on, the premise of playing on this sort of cultural awareness we now have of how wealthy people live. I think through reality television, we've been able to get an incredibly dimensional, whether we want it or not, idea of how wealthy people live their lives. And I thought it could be an interesting premise to examine as a comedy what would happen if all the money was taken away and these people were forced to confront what really matters in their lives. And I brought the idea to my dad, thinking, you know, his comedic sensibility is something that is very specific and grounded in something real, and I thought it could really lend itself to this concept, which I think has the potential or had the potential to go quite broad and cartoony. It needed the opposite. It needed something, an infusion of real, genuine comedy.
And when you say cartoonish, one of the things about this show, and I know that you've both talked about this before, is that because we get to know the characters and we see them in serious situations as well as funny moments, the comedy works even better.
Well, that's the it's a tack that we took that right off the top, and that was kind of a comedic tone that we had in the movies that Chris Guest and I did together.
Best in Show and others.
Yeah, which is a grounding of character where you never step outside of your character's boundaries to get a laugh.
And we always approach the show from day one as if it were a drama, and it is. I mean, inherently, it's quite tragic what happens to this family, and the comedy really comes from the characters interacting with each other and interacting with their circumstance. So I think because it's rooted in something real and we're not necessarily playing huge gags, you're able to tightrope walk that fine balance between comedy and also exploring slightly more emotional moments and revelations as well.
Another thing that I was thinking about is that fashion actually plays a pretty big role in the show. Every single character has something that they wear that's pretty unique, including you.
Certainly. You know, I think it was really important for me that fashion played a part, a big part in this show. I think because it was an area where we could explore character and not have to write it. And what clothes do in our show is act as a sort of perpetual reminder of where these people came from without having to continually say, remember that time when? Mm-hmm.
Now you can see where these people came from just by looking at them.
A wig store, for one, because your wife on the show, played by Catherine O'Hara.
Yeah.
By the way, you two have been husband and wife more than once now on screen.
We've done a few things together over the years, Catherine and I. Yeah, we were husband and wife in Best in Show. We were husband and wife in A Mighty Wind.
Right.
We were husband and wife in Over the Hedge.
What do you think it is about the chemistry that the two of you have that works so well time after time with different characters?
I think it's because we have the same style of working. You know, we both come out of improvisational background, mm-hmm. but we're basically actors at heart, not comedians. And we like to get our laughs through character, so everything's got to be set to the point where we know exactly what the character is going to be doing.
How much improv is there in what you're doing with Schitt's Creek?
I would say not very much. I mean, I would say it's 90 to 95% scripted. And
I think it's that extra 5, 10% that really adds that – it's like that special sauce to the show, giving people the freedom to experiment or ad-lib a little bit. Really sort of customizes each character. And I think from an acting standpoint, it allows you a little bit of freedom to like nestle into who you're playing and feel free to explore that a little bit. There's really no ego involved.
Can you think of an example of that happening? Something that you remember that was not scripted?
Well, I don't know. Usually at the end of scenes, when a scene is about to end and a character wants to kind of go on, knowing that they've got the ending to the scene, but what the hell?
I know that there's a scene in the first season between Annie and I where we're fighting over who sleeps in the bed closest to the door, because the idea is if a murderer were to come into the motel, whoever's sleeping closest to the door would get murdered first.
Right.
And Annie came up with this line, which was, "You get murdered first for once." And then it became this sort of back and forth, and we really ran with it. There's just some things like, you know, when Catherine O'Hara does a, you know, first walked in and did her accent as Moira.
You try enjoying a puff pastry with everyone around you scratching.
I could write very funny things for her, but nothing would be as funny as her delivering those lines in that accent. I mean, she just has the
ability. She came up with that herself?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah. Catherine's quite amazing. Mm-hmm. And on a show like this, you know, when you hire Catherine, you're getting more than just somebody who can deliver lines mm-hmm. funny. She brings everything to what she does. She adds so much to the character. She has her own ideas. The wigs, for example, mm-hmm. were her idea. So Moira would wear a different wig depending on, you know, her emotional
right.
mindset of that particular day. She adds so much.
I want to ask you, and let's listen to a clip from the show. This is a scene with a conversation between David, played by you, Daniel, and your boyfriend on the show and business partner, Patrick.
David, I've spent most of my life not knowing what right was supposed to feel like. And then I met you, and everything changed. You make me feel right, David.
That is quite possibly one of the most beautiful things I've ever heard anyone say. Outside of the Downton Christmas special.
It's the truth.
I know. It's just that my truth is that I am damaged goods, and this has really messed things up for me.
So one of the things about this show that I've never seen anywhere else is that you have a gay relationship that is never talked about by anybody in the town. The parents don't react. It's mm-hmm. not – it's just completely normal.
Yes, as it should be.
Right.
I tried to write my experience. I tried to write an experience that I know that friends of mine have had. I think that's the big thing that seems to be connecting with people, is the fact that there is an ease to the relationship and that we write the relationship in a casual way. And that was very deliberate. I think because, you know, we're so accustomed to seeing queer love stories that are put in jeopardy by outside forces. I mean, you know, it's the sort of Brokeback Mountain effect of any time you see two queer people in love, there has to be some kind of consequence. So to propose a world where there is no consequence and two people can love each other sort of wholly
in small town America.
In small town America, and ultimately show that what comes from that is freedom and love and joy. It's a form, I guess, of sort of quiet protest, saying that this is how things should be. And, you know, the choice to leave homophobia out of the equation on our show was deliberate because I'm a firm believer that we learn through what we see. And when we feel like we are being taught a lesson, we have our guards up. Because we don't want to be schooled on something, but to present something as it should be, I think has a much more powerful effect. And the letters that we've received from families who have watched the show together and it's changed their own relationships, it's a testament to the fact that it does seem to be working, even if it's just one family at a time.
Yeah, a love story is just a love story. And that's the tone that's set on the show. And as Dan just said, the effects are quite amazing when it comes to how it's affecting people out there.
And that was your experience?
Yeah. It was never questioned for me. I mean, sure, there was bullying in high school. But for me, my experience has been relatively easy compared to what is happening in many parts of this country and others. So meeting people in a respectful way and not pinning people against a wall with an agenda, but rather just sort of saying this is what we're doing.
Yeah, it just normalizes everything.
By the way, I said small town America. Where is Schitt's Creek? Have you actually said where it is physically? Do
nope.
we know?
Nope.
We haven't.
It's like Springfield in The Simpsons?
Yeah.
We,
yeah.
Know?
We have not. Schitt's Creek is Schitt's Creek.
Eugene and Dan Levy, co-stars and co-creators of Schitt's Creek, speaking with me last year. The show's final season was nominated this week for 15 Emmy Awards. NPR has learned there's been a critical change to plans for the 2020 census, the period of time when workers go door to door to get data from people who have not yet responded will end a month early. That risks a major undercount of people of color, people who live in rural communities, as well as young children. And there are growing concerns that the White House and Republicans in Congress are putting pressure on the census to wrap up counting quickly for political gain. NPR's Hansi Lo Wang covers the census and broke this story. He joins us now. Hansi, what have you learned about why the Census Bureau has moved up its field operations deadline?
Well, the Census Bureau has not officially announced this deadline, but I've confirmed it with three Census Bureau employees who were informed of these plans during internal meetings, and they spoke to NPR requesting that they not be identified because they fear that they might lose their jobs. But they say the new end date for door knocking for the 2020 census is September 30th and not October 31st, cutting it short by a month. And the Census Bureau has said in recent days that it is trying to move as quickly as possible. And it is also under this pressure here. There is federal law. There's a deadline the Census Bureau has to work under, which is by the end of this year, December 31st, it has to produce the latest state population counts to the president. That's part of the process for reapportioning seats in Congress among the states. And the Census Bureau asked back in April for an extension to that deadline for Congress to pass a new law. That has not happened yet. And the Bureau says it's now working towards December 31st.
And an estimated 4 in 10 households still haven't been counted by the census?
That's right. That's roughly the amount of work left for the Census Bureau at this point, with a self-response rate nationally at close to 63% at this point. But if you take a look at some local communities, some states, the self-response rate is much lower. So there's a lot of work still left to do. A lot of folks have gone online at my2020census.gov, have filled out a paper form, mailed it back, or called one of the toll-free numbers. But a lot of folks have not. And at this point of the census, based on Census Bureau's past past counts, this is at a point where most of the households that have not filled out a census form yet, they're not likely to do it on their own. They're only going to do it likely if someone is knocking on their door and there's that person-to-person interaction, which is a really big ask at a time of a pandemic where everyone's trying to socially distance.
Hadzi, you broke this story early this morning. What kind of reaction have you seen from lawmakers and others?
Well, Representative Grace Meng of New York, a Democrat, has put out a statement in response to NPR's report saying that additional time and flexibility is needed so the Bureau can ensure an accurate count while keeping its staff safe from COVID-19. And she is saying this is coming from part of a strategy, she says, from the White House, and that is a lot of concern. You hear that from a lot of concern from Democrats in Congress, that they are worried that this is part of a White House trying to undermine an accurate census, especially a count of people of color. And I've asked the White House press office to respond whether they support the Census Bureau's original request to extend deadlines, which will allow for extra time for counting. And the census and the White House press office has not responded to my questions.
NPR national correspondent Hansi Lo Wang. Hansi, thank you.
You're welcome.
Governments and biotech companies around the world are racing to develop a vaccine for the coronavirus. And our next guest says the world might have been better prepared for the pandemic if the United States had invested in developing practical applications for basic science for, say, infectious diseases. And he says that's just one example of how the U.S. has lost its way when it comes to innovation. Elon Gur is CEO of the tech fellowship program Activate. He writes in the MIT Technology Review that after World War II, the U.S. laid the technological foundation for our entire modern economy across telecommunications, space, defense, and health, and then we fell asleep at the wheel. And I spoke with him about that earlier.
The U.S. has historically been a leader in innovation because I would argue it had three magic ingredients going for it. It's had the world's best universities to create amazing talent and ideas. It had the world's strongest industrial research houses to turn those ideas into products. And then there's just an unmatched enterprising entrepreneurial spirit in the United States that's really key. And what you find has happened over time is the government has continued to focus on doubling down and supporting education, fundamental scientific research, but not so much on practical solutions, which the government generally leaves to the private sector. Meanwhile, the private sector has been doubling down on IT and apps. The private sector has been increasingly pressured to deliver quarterly earnings versus thinking about long-term value creation, and really has moved away from funding the kind of speculative or early-stage innovation that we need to build a better future. And it's not just about sort of addressing a challenge that's far in the future. You know, for me, I see this as an opportunity, right? So find me one American who wouldn't like to move beyond the century-old technology and infrastructure we're relying on for our homes, our roads, subways, airports. And instead, how do we build the future versions of these that are cleaner, better, more trusted, sustainable, accessible? When we look past our screens, our devices, our apps, and we think about all the ways that society needs to thrive in the next century, I feel like we're really falling short.
Yes, and you're talking about big problems, big issues within society like climate change, but even basic issues. For instance, the unemployment system within states and how convoluted the system is and how convoluted the federal unemployment system is. And yet there are entrepreneurs who likely have the answers to be able to solve those problems and get rid of the bottlenecks so that millions of people could actually get through and file for unemployment. I mean, that's a very, very basic example.
Yeah, and I think one of the encouraging trends we're seeing is the philanthropic world is doing a really great job of catching up with the idea that entrepreneurship can help drive social solutions. Philanthropy, I think, is doing that well. I think government needs to catch up there. Our focus at Activate has been on a set of social innovators for which it's very, very hard to support them because the innovations they're doing, things like creating new ways for CO2 to be captured, you know, these are big infrastructure innovations. And so they need that extra support, and the importance of those innovations is really profound.
Yeah. Speaking of which, I mean, you have experience in how to turn scientific discoveries in particular into business and applied technology. In 2014, you started a fellowship program that did just that. You were a program director at the U.S. Department of Energy's Advanced Research Projects Agency. Based on your own interactions and experiences, what is the one thing that really sticks out to you about really the state of innovation in the U.S. right now and how perhaps interacting with governmental systems have impeded the progress that you're talking about?
Yeah, great question. I mean, here's the story. We have some of the most amazing enterprising talent in terms of innovation talent in the world. The U.S. graduates 40,000 science and engineering PhDs alone every year. These are folks that we collectively have funded to become cutting-edge experts in fields like chemistry and physics and material science. These are folks who have the ability to go create this infrastructure of the future that we all want to see. And what you find is while our innovation system, we're in a renaissance age of innovation where, you know, someone who wants to build an internet app can essentially drop out of school and sit at a coffee shop and start iterating on their ideas. These types of innovators, these kind of harder science innovators, they don't have a path to move their ideas forward, largely because the innovation that they're talking about doing requires a different level of investment and support. And at the earliest stages of these things, they're still too speculative to be taken up by venture capitalists and corporations. And yet, in today's system, the government sees them as too applied for kind of the traditional academic research that the government funds. And so, my biggest observation and the biggest pain point that I've seen is we just have this incredible wealth of talent and ideas that could create a better future that are stranded. The organization that I run, Activate, sort of we set up to provide a path for cutting edge scientists to be entrepreneurial, moving their ideas into the market to address these big social needs. You know, for the last 5 years, we've been working taking top scientists, entrepreneurial scientists who want to commit their life to that pursuit, giving them a couple of years with access to partner research labs to be entrepreneurial and create technologies like better batteries for cars and the electricity grid or geothermal energy or ways to capture CO2. And the work they're doing is sort of stuck where it doesn't fit into the kind of academic research world, but it also doesn't fit into what the normal marketplace is doing right now in terms of supporting innovation. And until we can find a way for both government and industry to step up and say, no, we need to find a way to partner to support this type of innovation at the right scale. Until that happens, I think the best shot we've got is tapping into this entrepreneurial spirit and supporting innovators who really want to drive that future.
The U.S. is key in all of this. You went back to World War II and talking about that foundation. Why does it matter if the U.S. isn't the leader in innovation anymore?
Oh, wow. That's a big, important question. The idea that the United States as a leader in democratic ideals is not at the forefront of technology innovation that we as people worldwide are relying on is a really critical threat to those ideals. I think the biggest magic ingredient that we have in the U.S. To drive innovation is this entrepreneurial spirit. And what we found is that in supporting research and development, the government hasn't caught up in the times in recognizing that amazing scientific research, technical innovation can be done now by small entrepreneurial shops, not just, you know, kind of big institutions. And we need to find a way to support that spirit.
Is there another country that you feel like does a better job in translating basic science and technology into solutions? And what could we learn from them?
Well, I would say, you know, the thing that in the U.S. has really faltered is this component of how do you take speculative research and turn it into products in these areas outside of IT. If you look at other parts of the world, there are governments out there that have been much more aggressive in supporting solutions to societal problems, solutions to big opportunities. If you look at Europe in climate change and energy, you know, lots of incentives towards creating a market for clean energy. The enormous solar energy market around the world really started from incentives in Japan and Germany that said, we want to see this happen. There was no market, and they created a market. And it's an enormous global market right now. So you can think about those sorts of countries. You can look at a place like China that has been really aggressive at funding, frankly, the combination of both cutting-edge research and education in a fundamental level and in really strong investments in industrial research. And that's a powerful, powerful combination. And I would say the one thing that still no other country has in anywhere near the magnitude that we have in the United States is the enterprising entrepreneurial spirit. You know, we've got this magic tool, this magic weapon in our bag. And so I think there's a lot to be excited about and hopeful about, and a lot of opportunity.
That's Elon Gur, CEO of Activate. And we'll link you to his piece, How the U.S. Lost Its Way on Innovation, in the MIT Technology Review at hereandnow.org. Elon, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks so much for the opportunity, Tanya.
President Trump mused on Twitter yesterday about delaying the election in November. He was asked at a press conference if he was trying to cast doubt on the results of the election with his tweet.
I didn't know it was going to be the impact it had. What people are now looking at is, am I right? But not me. Are all these stories right about the fact that these elections will be fraudulent? They'll be fixed. They'll be rigged.
Even the co-founder of the Conservative Federalist Society, a Trump supporter, called Trump's suggestion fascistic and said it was grounds for the president's immediate impeachment again. Let's see how all this is playing on social media with Femi Okeh, host of The Stream on Al Jazeera English. Hi, Femi.
Hello there, Jeremy. The pundits were very quick to respond, telling the president that this wasn't constitutional at all. You couldn't just delay the election. But the interesting conversation came from the people. So Heath, for instance, says, so it's not safe to go out and vote, but it is safe enough to open schools. Can you explain your logic, please, coherently and with an actual answer? That would be nice. And then also a lot of support, very vocal support for the president. For instance, Matthew Conway, big supporter of President Trump. We trust your judgment, President Trump. So it's back and forth about whether you can delay the election. That is very solidly, no, you can't without changing the law. And then questions about how you may or may not be able to vote. But in the case of it being an engaging question, because the president did ask a question, it did really well. He had over 130,000 retweets and comments and engaging. So if it was a genuine question, he got several genuine answers.
And of course, President Trump has no authority to move Election Day. Congress would have to do that, and several congressional Republicans have already ruled it out. Let me ask you about something else, Femi. On Instagram, women have been posting black and white photos of themselves with the captions, "Women Supporting Women" and "Challenge Accepted." The hashtag was taken up by some to protest violence against women in Turkey, but Instagram has said the most recent version of the trend actually originated in Brazil, and it has been around in some form since 2016. Explain what this is all about.
Well, when I first saw Challenge Accepted just popping up in lots of people's social feeds, beautiful pictures of friends, colleagues, strangers in black and white, the challenge doesn't even tell you what it is. So what challenge is accepted? So you dig a little bit deeper, and then you realize that the women are tagging other women that they admire. They're supporting them. It's an expression of female empowerment. How popular is this? So this morning, I just checked out to see how many posts had challenge accepted on them on Instagram. Over 6 million posts. So first criticism is vanity, and that comes from social. So Caroline Moss on Twitter says, I literally cannot get over the challenge accepted. Here's a hot photo of myself because I support women. She's making fun of the women posting the cute pictures. But if we dig a little bit deeper, Suyatis Elabella is from Turkey. And she said, well, if you look closely at this hashtag campaign, it goes back to 2016 when it was used for cancer awareness. It has been used in Brazil. But this July, we have been using it in Turkey to draw attention to the women who are murdered, to draw attention to femicide, which is a real problem, gender-based violence in Turkey. And often when the media prints the pictures of the women who are missing or the women who are murdered, they're black and white pictures. So the women in Turkey were posting their own black and white pictures, almost as if to say, one, we could be next, and two, we support you, we are there for you, we need our government to do more. That was the challenge. That was the challenge accepted. It went global. It picked up. So it's become a much deeper campaign than it started off as.
One more thing I have to ask you about, and really just because I love to have you help us have a smile on a Friday every week, something that caught your eye on social media this week. A Domino's Pizza in New Zealand was forced to stop its promotion, offering free pizza to, quote, nice Karens. What's going on there?
Oh, so Domino's Pizza in New Zealand and also in Australia decided that there were so many stories about women behaving terribly and not wearing their masks and being outwardly racist that they thought it was a really tough time to be called a Karen, because often these women, the vernacular term for these women who are white and privileged and behaving badly, is you're a Karen. So Domino's says, all of you nice Karens, it's a tough time to be a Karen. We are going to give you free pizza. Fill out this form, tell us why you're a nice Karen, and we will send you maybe a free pizza. People pointed out that it was a very rude, insensitive campaign. And so on Facebook shortly afterwards, Domino's posted, said, we're sorry, we just wanted to bring a smile to our customers' faces with our pizza and our social media. And we didn't really want to insult anybody, and we're learning. So Karens in New Zealand and Australia, the nice Karens, no free pizza for you. Sorry about that. But keep on being nice.
Every time I hear about these Karens, I just feel terrible for our good friends. In fact, one of our producers is named
great
Karen.
Karens. There are
so many good Karens out there. Femi Oke, host of the stream on Al Jazeera English. Thanks as always.
You're so welcome.
Tanya, poor Karen Miller-Medson. It must be difficult for her.
I think about it every time.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Tanya Mosley. This is Here and Now.